Back again with Hitler's War by David Irving. Chapter is Hitler Takes Command. In the dark months of that winter, Hitler showed his iron determination. Where his generals saw an ignominious withdrawal as their only salvation, he told them to stand firm until the spring thaw arrived, to halt the enemy offensive. When they demurred, argued, and disobeyed, Hitler dismissed and disgraced them, and himself took command of the German army, until a new spirit gradually prevailed along the Eastern Front. Hitler's powers to influence were remarkable. Soon hardened commanders were swearing they had seen Hitler in the thick of battle. Quote, "We thought it was all over, but then the Führer toured our sector calling for one last ounce of effort from us, and we pulled through," end quote. But many more months would pass before he risked leaving his headquarters. Quote, "I had to act ruthlessly. I had to send even my closest generals packing, two army generals, for example, whose strength was gone and who were at the end of their tether. In winter, one of them came and announced, 'Mein Führer, we can't hold on any longer. We've got to retreat.' I asked him, 'Sir, where in God's name are you thinking of retreating to? How far?' 'Well,' he answered, I don't really know. Do you plan to drop back 30 miles? Do you think it isn't all that cold there, then? And do you imagine your transport and supply problems will be any better there? And if you retreat, do you intend to take your heavy weapons with you? Can you take them?' This man answered, 'No, it can't be done.' 'So you're planning to leave them to the Russians, and how do you think you're going to fight further back if you haven't got any heavy weapons?' he responded. 'Mein Führer, save at least the army, whatever happens to its guns.' So I inquired, 'Are you planning to just retreat to the Reich frontier, or what? Where do you plan to call a halt?' 'Well, Mein Führer,' he rejoined, 'we probably won't get any choice. I could only tell these gentlemen, get yourself back to Germany as rapidly as you can, but leave the army in my charge, and the army is staying at the front.'" End quote. The Soviet counteroffensive had torn open a 30-mile-wide gap between Kluge's and Guderian's armies. More and more Russian troops and tanks poured through the breach. The most effective anti-tank weapon, the Redhead shell with a hollow-charge warhead, which Hitler had first seen demonstrated on November 25th, had immediately been embargoed by him to keep it secret from the enemy. The fear of Russian captivity and the lack of weapons fuel, fodder for the horses and reserves, produced in his troops a crushing sense of inferiority. Quote, "We have seriously underestimated the enemy, the size of his country and the vagaries of the climate," end quote, Guderian gloomily wrote on December 10th. Quote, "And now we're paying for it," end quote. Hitler sent the army's ailing commander-in-chief, von Brauchitsch, to the Moscow front to see the situation for himself. Guderian met him on December 14th at Rostov. He wrote afterward, quote, "It took 22 hours to drive through the blizzard to reach him," end quote. Brauchitsch ordered Guderian to hold the line forward of Kursk, but like Bock and Kluge, the tank commander knew only one solution: retreat while the going was still good. Hitler turned a deaf ear on them all. Quote, "I can't send everybody home just because Army Group Center is beginning to leak," end quote, he argued, and he was encouraged by anguished appeals from the other sector commanders not to let a wholesale rout begin. Army Group Center's most urgent need was for reserves. Late on December 14th, Hitler ordered Jodl to find out how much could be scraped together in the Reich. General Friedrich Fromm explained that his replacement army had a number of divisions under training. Half an hour after midnight, Hitler ordered Fromm to come to the Chancellery. The general undertook to raise 4.5 divisions at once, equipped with winter clothing and skis. At 1 p.m. the next day, Hitler telephoned Field Marshal Lieb, who was now asking permission to pull back his army group north to Volkhov River. Hitler pointed out that this would enable the Russians to pour more troops and supplies into Leningrad. As his special train left Berlin that evening, Hitler drafted his first halt order to the Eastern Front. Quote, any large-scale retreat by major sections of army in midwinter, given only limited mobility, insufficient winter equipment, and no prepared positions in the rear, must inevitably have the gravest consequences, end quote. The Fourth Army was ordered not to fall back one foot. This controversial order was hotly debated during the night. Lossberg argued that it was time for the strategic command of the war to be delegated to an acknowledged expert like General von Manstein. Jodl, emerging from Hitler's conference car, revealed quietly, quote, the Führer has already decided on a different way of resolving the command problem, end quote. It was 11 a.m., December 16th, when Hitler arrived back at the Wolf's lair. His halt order was dictated to Bach over the telephone by Halder at 12:10 p.m. To the visiting Dr. Goebbels, he confided that day that he had decided to replace all three Army Group commanders. They all had stomach ailments, he scoffed. Perhaps he was using the term Magenkrank sarcastically. Hitler no longer trusted Brauchitsch's judgment. He had his chief adjutant, Rudolf Schmundt, flown to the Moscow front. Schmundt returned with an accurate account of Guderian's litany of worries, Schmundt returned with an accurate account of Guderian's litany of worries, told him in an hour-long conference on Oral Airfield. There we go. At last, the truth was reaching Hitler. Waiting for the Führer to telephone him about reinforcements that evening, Guderian wrote to his wife, quote, heaven knows we're going to extricate ourselves. I'm just glad that the Führer at least knows what's happening, and I hope he'll come to grips with his customary verve with the bureaucratic wheels of the War Department, railroad, and other machinery. I lie awake at night racking my brain about how I can help my poor men, who have no protection against this fierce winter weather, end quote. Toward midnight, Bach telephoned Schmundt with the text of his own three-day-old report to Brauchitsch. It read, quote, the Führer must decide for himself whether the Army Group must stand and fight, thereby risking its total destruction, or retreat, entailing precisely the same risk. If he decides on retreat, then he must realize that it is unlikely that enough troops will ever get back to the new line to hold it, and that it will be unprepared for them, and not all that much shorter, end quote. Brauchitsch had suppressed this report rather than show it to Hitler. Over the phone, Bach now added that his 267th Infantry Division had that very day been forced to abandon its entire artillery in the retreat. Hitler telephoned him in person, quote, in this situation there is only one answer, and that is not to yield one inch, to plug the gaps and hold on, end quote. Bach grimly replied that his front might cave in any moment. Hitler responded clearly, quote, that is a risk I must take, end quote. Quote, there is only one thing that ails our front, he explained to Brauchitsch and Halder a few moments later. The enemy just has more soldiers than us, end quote. This was why they must rush the simplest reinforcements, riflemen, each provisioned with 8 or 10 days, canned food, alcohol, and chocolate, by train to the Russian front. 1,000 trucks must be supplied to Bach as well, and 2,000 SS troops must be flown east from Krakow. At 3 a.m., he telephoned Guderian with details of the reinforcements. Later that day, December 17th, General von Richthofen came to the Wolf's lair with Goering. The Luftwaffe Corps commander wrote in his diary, quote, Jeschenik and I went in to see the Führer. He's a bundle of nerves, but clear-headed and confident. I kept emphasizing that what matters now is keeping our troops alive and fighting where they are. What the front lacks is riflemen, winter gear, and food, but above all, the will to stand fast. I emphasized the need for him to appeal to each soldier in person. Then it will be all right. The Führer listened with enormous interest and concentration. He's planning a major proclamation. Reichsmarshal Goering and I were very persuasive. Führer swears loudly about the army commanders responsible for the foul-ups. Is grappling with big reshuffle. End quote. Hitler himself signed the order that now went out to the Eastern Front, which is as follows. And, quote, start, major withdrawal movements cannot be made. They will result in the complete loss of heavy weapons and equipment. Under the personal leadership of commanders and officers alike, the troops are to be forced to put up a fanatical resistance in their lines, regardless of any enemy breakthrough in their flanks and rear. Only this kind of fighting will win. The time we need to move up the reinforcements I have ordered from the home country and the West. End quote. This was no time to respect personal feelings. Hitler ordered Field Marshal von Kluge to take over Army Group Center. Hitler attached no blame to Bock and asked Schmutt to make his plan to the field to make this plain to the Field Marshal. Less cordial was his parting with Field Marshal von Brauchitsch, the army's commander in chief. The impression he had gained on his visit to Rundstedt's army group 2 weeks earlier, the facts were being withheld from him, was confirmed by the inexplicable suppression of Bock's alarming message of the 13th. Later in December, Hitler issued a basic order to all Wehrmacht commands, reminding them of the need to respect such reports as an indispensable instrument of leadership. Quote, it is the duty of every soldier to report unfulfilled orders and his own errors truthfully, end quote, and to report without exaggeration or dangerous embellishment. More serious were the recent indications of Brauchitsch's inability or reluctance to execute Hitler's orders. By December 19th, his mind was made up. He would follow Schmutz's advice and take command of the army himself. He knew of no general capable of instilling the National Socialist spirit into the army. He explained to Brauchitsch in a loud voice that day, and he added almost inaudibly, quote, we shall remain friends, end quote. Halder would have to carry on as before. While Keitel assumed the ministerial functions of the war ministry. It surprised many that Halder had not shared the fate of Brauchitsch, but Hitler needed the chief of general staff for his ability and experience, and the ambitious general learned to swallow his aversion as a professional to the upstart dictator. Meanwhile, Hitler and Schmutt composed an order of the day to the soldiers of the army and the Waffen-SS. Quote, our country's struggle for freedom is approaching its climax. We are forced by world-shaking decisions. The prime bearer of the struggle is the army. As of today, I have therefore taken command of the army myself. As a soldier in many battles of World War I, I share deeply with you the determination to win through. Adolf Hitler, end quote. General Guderian was the next to go. It had slowly dawned on his superiors that he was preparing his 2nd Panzer Army's retreat. This was clear to Halder from the way the tanks were being regrouped around Orel and the army was being echeloned in depth. Kluge, who had succeeded Bock, was no friend of Guderian, and when the latter arrived at Hitler's headquarters on December 20th, Kluge telephoned Halder and Schmutt to warn them that Guderian had lost his nerve. Guderian dramatically set out to the Führer the condition that the 2nd Panzer Army, his groups were exhausted and outnumbered. It was impossible to dig in, as the ground was frozen solid. Hitler reported, quote, then use your heavy artillery or mortars to blast out craters and install trench heaters in them, end quote. At one stage, he caustically inquired of Guderian, quote, do you believe that Frederick the Great's grenadiers enjoyed dying for their country either? End quote. Guderian, for his part, hinted that it was high time for Hitler to rid himself of chair-bound experts like Keitel, Jodl, and Halder, who had never seen the front line. He flew back to Orel the next day and briefed his commanders on Hitler's renewed halt order, but his tanks' stealthy withdrawal still continued. Finally, on December 25th, Kluge refused to work with Guderian any longer. One or the other of them must leave. Shortly before midnight, Hitler telephoned Kluge back. Guderian was being relieved of his command forthwith. Having assumed command of the German army, Hitler was buried by an avalanche of work. For weeks on end, he knew no regular routine. The tea party in his bunker now never started before midnight. Once that winter, it started after 2 a.m., which meant that his weary partners were unable to retire to bed before 4 or 5. Hitler slept in his bunker with the ventilation system humming all night and the drought blowing on his head. Christmas at his headquarters was always a cheerless affair, very different from that celebrated in the Berlin ministries, for example. Hitler received his staff in turn, handed them an envelope containing a small sum of Reichsmarks, and sometimes sent them a packet of coffee with a typed note of good wishes. Hüllel wrote in his diary on the 24th, quote, "A dispirited Christmas. Führer's thoughts are elsewhere. No candles lit." End quote. 2 days before, Hitler had learned from Kluge that the general staff were sending hundreds of half-frozen troops by air to Smolensk, without weapons or winter gear. He had shouted into the phone, quote, "Another Schweinerei," Kluge warned him. "I have a feeling we have..." That was end of quote, a Schweinerei. Kluge warned him, quote, "I have a feeling we shall be facing a major decision tomorrow," end quote. Hitler left the embargo on the Red Guard hollow charge anti-tank shells. A fragment of another famous diary, that of Canaris, graphically portrays the atmosphere. Quote, December 24th, 1941. General Schmundt is drawing comparisons with 1812 and talks of the moment of truth for National Socialism. The equipment losses are horrifying. Trucks, guns, and aircraft have to be destroyed or abandoned because we lack the fuel to bring them back. All this has a grim effect on our soldiers' fighting morale, as they suddenly realize that they are being badly led. The Führer's actions, retiring von Brauchitsch and a number of commanders, are quite right to have been to have befallen. The Führer's actions are quite right to have befallen those who are by no means blameless, whatever people may say about them. Our own treatment of Russian prisoners is having awful consequences. In the retreat from Moscow, we had to abandon German field hospitals as well. The Russians dragged out the sick and injured, hanged them upside down, poured gasoline over them, and set them on fire. On another occasion, German prisoners were beheaded and their heads laid out to form the SS symbol. I think that's the end of the quote. When the International Red Cross now proposed that both sides return to the accepted conventions, Hitler refused, telling Keitel and Jodl that he did not want his troops to get the idea that the Russians would treat them decently in captivity. The year's end had come. The dam on the Eastern Front might break at any moment. Kluge was again asking for withdrawals, and Hitler was grimly observing that they might just as well fall back on the Dnieper or the Polish frontier. Hitler related to the field marshal how, as a simple infantryman in Flanders, he and his comrades had withstood 10 days of ceaseless bombardment and nevertheless had held the line. Kluge rejoined that Hitler had not been fighting at minus 25 degrees. Quote, "My corps commander has told me that if the 15th Infantry Division is ordered to stand fast, the troops are so exhausted they will not obey," end quote. Hitler angrily said, quote, "If that is so, then it is the end of the German army," end quote, and he ended the conversation. None of Hitler's staff would forget the New Year's Eve that followed. Throughout the day, Kluge had been on the phone to General Halder, begging for permission to withdraw. Hitler flatly refused. Any strategic retreat was bound to touch off a general collapse. He demanded a fight to the finish in order to win time until the reinforcements arrived. Supper was again served late. Hitler dozed off afterward, exhausted, while the last minutes of the old year ticked away. His staff gathered expectantly in the mess and waited for him. But at 11:30, Kluge phoned urgently from the front, and for the next 3 hours, the time is graven in the diaries of Bormann, Hüllel, and the army group itself. Hitler wrangled the field marshal, arguing and cajoling on the need to stand fast. Hitler refused outright to grant Kluge freedom to withdraw what amounted to a 90-mile section of frontier over 20 miles. Not until 2:30 a.m. did Hitler arrive for tea with his intimate staff. Quote, I am glad I know how to overcome even the greatest difficulties, he said. Let's hope 1942 brings me as much good fortune as 1941. The worries can stay. So far, the pattern has always been this. The hardest times come first, as a kind of preparation for the really great events. End quote. In the corner of the phonograph was playing Bruckner's Seventh, but nobody was in the mood for it. Hitler's private secretary, Christa Schroeder, wrote 2 weeks later, quote, "On New Year's Eve, we were all in cheerful mood. We're all in a cheerful enough mood at supper in the number 2 mess, After that, we were ordered over to the regular tea session, where we found a very wary chief, who nodded off after a while. So we accordingly kept very quiet, which completely stifled what high spirits had been able to summon up. After that, the chief was away for 3 hours in conference, while the menfolk who had been mustered to offer New Year greetings hung around with doom-laden faces, not daring to allow a smile to pass their lips. I just can't describe it. At any rate, it was so ghastly that I broke down in tears in my bunker, and when I went back to the mess, I ran into a couple of the lads from the escort command, who of course saw at once that I had been crying, which set me off all over again, whereupon they tried to comfort me with words and alcohol, successfully. We all sang a sea shanty at the top of our voices. At anchor off Madagascar, and we've got the plague aboard. End quote. Hitler's rigid leadership stabilized the front for long enough. In mid-January 1942, he could authorize Kluge to withdraw the more exposed sections of his group. By now, a new defensive line had been prepared. Reserves were arriving, warm clothing had been contributed by the German public, and most of the heavy equipment could be salvaged in time. The winter crisis had been mastered, but the cost in officers was high. Ousted by Hitler, poor encourager L'Altrus, whatever, General Otto Forster, the engineer general who had already incurred Hitler's displeasure once in a 1938 dispute over fortifications, was dismissed for withdrawing his corps. Field Marshal von Reichenau died of a stroke. Bock, miraculously recovered, was appointed to replace him at Army Group South. General Hans von Sponeck, who had abandoned Kirsch, was sentenced to be shot, though Hitler commuted this sentence. General Hoppner, who prematurely withdrew his Panzergruppe to the winter line on January 8th, was dismissed from the army in disgrace. Outraged at the loss of his, quote, well-earned pension rights, Hoppner instituted a law against the Reich in the Berlin courts and won. Hitler declared himself above the law and summoned the Reichstag on April 26th to endorse a decree to that effect. The decree gave him powers over every person in the Reich, regardless, quote, regardless of their so-called well-earned rights, end quote. It puzzled many Germans that an absolute dictator should need to arrogate seemingly superfluous powers to himself. But as Goebbels learned, Hitler's aim was to legalize in advance the radical steps he planned against, quote, reactionaries, civil servants, lawyers, and certain sections of the officer corps, end quote. Throughout December and January 1942, intelligence reports had trickled into Hitler's headquarters indicating an Anglo-American plan to invade northern Norway, in the spring. The sources were ominously similar to those proven accurate in the anxious spring of 1940. He suspected that the enemy had secretly promised Narvik to Sweden. With this in mind, Hitler ordered the reinforcement of his fleet in Norway. The battleships Scharnhorst and Nisenau had been bottled up at Brest on France's Atlantic coast since the spring, and had been regularly crippled by bomb damage ever since. Hitler was impatient at their enforced idleness. On December 26th, his naval adjutant put to him the Admiralty's request for extra air support for their next exercises. This was the last straw. Quote, I was always a champion of big ships before, Hitler announced. My heart was in them, but they've had their day. The danger of air attack is too great, end quote. He sent for Raeder to discuss withdrawing the battleships to Norway, where they would have a new lease on life. On December 29th, he told Raeder to bring them back from Brest, since routing them around the British Isles would invite certain disaster. Hitler suggested taking the warships back through the English Channel. Hitler explained to his naval adjutant on January 4th that surprise was of the essence. Quote, any steps which might somehow alert the British are to be avoided, the adjutant noted. If the withdrawal comes off, he would like to see every possible ship transferred to Norway. This is the only step likely to have a deterrent effect on the British. Since Churchill has stated that the British still have the bloodiest sacrifices to bear, he considers an invasion of Norway quite likely. End quote. Vice Admiral Otto Siliax insisted on reaching the 17-mile-wide Dover Straits at high noon. This was inevitable if the warships were to slip out of Brest under cover of dusk. Raeder was unhappy about the whole venture, but the alternative, scrapping the big warships altogether, did not bear thinking about. The attempt would be made in 1 month's time. It was probably not until February 1942 that Hitler could form a realistic picture of the Moloch of defeat from which he had snatched his army. The army had counted 112,627 frost victims by February 20th, of which no fewer than 14,357 were amputees. Barbarossa had now cost the German forces close to 1 million casualties, including 200,000 dead. The bitterness within the army's ranks was directed, however, not at Hitler, but at his generals. And I think we've concluded that's kind of accurate. One vivid narrative by an ordinary soldier filtered up through SS channels to Bormann. His battalion had marched about aimlessly for some 300 miles before being hurled into action on the Donets. Quote, "Too late and without any heavy guns, without even a single anti-tank gun, our battalion was thrown into the breach as a so-called stopgap force. The Russians came at us, of course, with heavy tanks and enormous masses of infantry and pushed us back. Our machine guns wouldn't fire because of the bitter cold, and our ammunition ran out." Meantime, the entire front was beginning to cave in, about 60 miles across. Everywhere, troops were flooding back in disorder, losing their heads. In vain, officers confronted them at pistol point, trying to restore order in this chaos. Panic had broken out everywhere. You saw scenes we had never witnessed even with the Russians, and only rarely with the French in France. Columns of troops streaming back, often several abreast on the road. Steel helmets, guns, gas masks, and equipment littered the whole area. Hundreds of trucks set on fire by our troops because they could not move them for the lack of gasoline or because of the frost and snowdrifts. Blazing ammunition dumps, clothing stores, food depots. The roads of retreat were strewn with dead horses and broken down vehicles. Upon this scene of chaos, there pounced German dive bombers, adding the final touches of perfection to the destruction. Shapeless huddles of misery swathed in blankets, their legs wrapped in rags and bandages, hobbled along the roads looking like something from scenes of Napoleon's retreat. For 4 days, our battalion fought on, screening this hideous retreat. By the 5th day, the Russian tanks had overtaken us, shot us to pieces, and wiped out the rest of our battalion. I myself escaped the tanks, which took a fiendish pleasure in hounding down each of our men until he was flattened beneath its tracks, by running into a deep pit where the snowdrifts barred the tank's pursuit. We survivors of this catastrophe, concluded this soldier, have only one wish, that the Führer wreak a terrible judgment on the guilty ones. End quote. Hitler's thoughts were already with the coming spring offensive. He had hoped to begin advancing army groups south into the Caucasus late in April, as he explained to the Japanese, from whom he concealed few of his true ambitions. A southern thrust rather than the capture of Moscow offered many advantages. It would cure the oil problem, it would keep Turkey neutral, and if all went well, the autumn might see the Wehrmacht advancing on Baghdad. He disclosed his plan to von Bock on January 18th before he flew out to take command of his army group south at Poltava, 700 miles away. Hitler already realized that the war would continue into 1943. On February 9th, Goering conferred with him on, quote, responsibility for the prompt provision of locomotives for the winter of 1942-43, end quote. The equipment was to be of a kind capable of surviving the Russian winter. Germany's allies were initially unenthusiastic about a spring offensive. Field Marshal Keitel, in an undoubted feat of diplomacy, however, persuaded both Romania and Hungary to increase their contingents on the Eastern Front. Italy also agreed to send more divisions east. Bulgaria, strongly sympathetic to Russia, remained non-aligned. Her king, although an admirer of Hitler's, was pleased that he asked nothing more of Bulgaria's army than it dissuade Turkey from foolish undertakings. Turkey's feelings were evidently warming toward Hitler anyway, even as the spring thaws melted northward across Russia. The Turkish president privately assured Franz von Papen that he was as convinced as ever of Germany's ultimate victory. Learning from Forschungsoft intercepts that a disgruntled Britain was discontinuing her arms supplies to Turkey, in April, Hitler agreed that Germany would supply the Turks with tanks, guns, submarines, and aircraft. Neutral nations and Germany's allies were not the only ones demanding the products of the Germans' arms industry. Seated in his private plane on December 3rd while flying to the Eastern Front, Hitler had dictated to a munitions minister, Fritz Tott, a 3-day decree ordering the simplification and expansion of arms production. Basically, future arms manufacture was to be concentrated in the most efficient factories, turning out standardized and unsophisticated weapons by mass production means. Tott initiated a radical reform of the arms industry structure. On January 10, 1942, Hitler ordered the industry to revert to its earlier preferential treatment of the Army's needs at the expense of the Luftwaffe and Navy, although the long-term objectives remained unaltered, i.e., the focus of the fighting effort of the latter two services was to be directed against the Western Allies. Later in January, Tott outlined his proposed reforms to Hitler. The arms combines would supervise their own projects and, quote, a fixed contract price system would be introduced. On February 7th, Tott dined with him. By 9:45 a.m. next morning, he was dead, his charred remains lying in the wreckage of his Heinkel, which had crashed on takeoff at Rostenburg. Aw. Hitler was desolate at the loss. He ordered the Air Ministry to design a cockpit recorder to install in future planes to register the cause of any accidents. Hitler returned to Berlin to bury Tott. These were momentous hours. As his train pulled into the Reich capital, his battleships were in the English Channel. At noon, they would be passing through the Straits of Dover. In the Far East, the final Japanese assault on Singapore, bastion of the British Empire, had just begun. It looked like the end of India, too. By the early hours of February 13th, the German fleet's strategic withdrawal from the Atlantic to northern waters had been successfully completed. The Scharnhorst had reached Wilhelmshaven, despite damage from two mines. The Gneisenau had reached Kiel, also dented by a mine. The Prince Eugen had got through unscathed. In the air battles, the British had lost 20 bombers, 16 fighters, and 6 torpedo planes. Adolf Galland had lost only 7 fighters. The London Times commented, quote, "Nothing more mortifying to the pride of sea power has happened in home waters since the 17th century," end quote. Hitler, who had trembled for the safety of our ships, as Goebbels witnessed, now breathed again. Next day, Hitler spoke to 10,000 newly commissioned lieutenants assembled in Berlin's Sportpalast. The photographs show him looking stern and flanked by Keitel, Milch, and Himmler, gripping the lectern. As he left the platform, a thunderous cheering broke out, and out of the clamor swelled 10,000 young voices united in the national anthem. The next evening, his train bore him back to his headquarters in East Prussia. Toward midnight, Joachim von Ribbentrop came along the swaying corridor with news that Churchill had just broadcast the announcement of the fall of Singapore. To Fräulein Schroeder, the Nazi foreign minister dictated a gloating draft communique for the press to publish next morning. Hitler shook his head and advised Ribbentrop, quote, "We have to think in terms of centuries. Who knows, in the future, the yellow peril may well be the biggest one for us," end quote. He tore the document in half. And there it is, the whole chapter.